Welcome to the JPGN Journal Club, hosted by Dr. Alex Nicely and Dr. Jake Mann.
Well, hello and welcome to you too. I want to point something out to people who are listening at home in that if I sound a little bit different, it's because I had cardiac surgery fairly recently, and that seems to have left me with some vocal cord damage. So it's not going to be the poured honey that you're used to. It's going to be more like rock candy. What can I tell you? Little lumps and bumps and crumps all the way through it. That won't change, however, the fact that Jake Mann is leading the JPGN Journal Club today with two articles, one from JPGN and one from Hepatology. But before we get into that, let me urge you to check out what SPGN has available from July onward. I should say from September onward, since August seems to be a gap month. There's the AHP Summer School on the 12th, the Young Investigator Forum on the 21st, and on the 25th, the 5th Liver Transplant School, all available on the SPGN website, and I hope you go and take a look and decide to avail yourself of some of these educational opportunities. So now here we are with two articles to be discussed. One of them is a case review of instances of autoimmune gastritis by Granot et al. In Journal of Pediatric Gastroenterology and Nutrition. And the title of that is Clinical Characteristics and Outcomes of Pediatric Patients with Autoimmune Gastritis. There's a bibliographic reference in the online introduction to this talk. And there's from Hepatology by Lefer et al., Development and Validation of PFIB Scores, Pediatric Fibrosis Scores, I should say, for Exclusion of Significant Liver Fibrosis in Pediatric MASLD, Metabolic Associated Steatotic Liver Disease. I knew I'd sort that out. Jake, why did you pick these two articles? Because I found them as a histopathologist. Both of them were a bit of a disappointment.
Not for that reason. It wasn't intentionally to disappoint you. I guess I wanted to pick the autoimmune gastritis paper because it's a diagnosis I'm moderately convinced I've never made. And I wanted to read this paper in detail and to really understand why that might be the case. And then MASLD, or MASLD, is probably the most common reason for referral to our outpatient clinics at the moment, and any tool that may help in risk stratification is potentially of interest.
Well, the first article by Granot et al., let's get into that. It strikes me as being pretty much an alarm that pernicious anemia or gastric mucosal malignant change are complications to be watched out for in children with iron deficiency. The link being, of course, that autoimmune gastritis then boosts your gastrin levels as they attempt to charge up cells that are no longer there. And with that, you get neuroendocrine neoplasia. While down the road in the terminal ileum, there's no vitamin B12 available, intrinsic factor having gone askew with, to serve hemopoiesis. But this is 33 or 30-odd cases collected from a number of institutions over 20-plus years. 33 cases in 20-plus years. Are you still surprised that you've never diagnosed?
No. After reading the paper, you know, these are several major institutions, very experienced pediatric GI physicians, and, yeah, a small number of cases. The main presentation here was with iron deficiency anemia, with perhaps other associated features like short stature or some abdominal pain. And I guess my main first take home was that probably in the UK, many of these patients would not routinely have an upper GI endoscopy if they had presented with iron deficiency anemia. Unless it was really severe and refractory in children, we would generally just treat them and see what their response was, particularly given that the mainstay of treatment for these patients was proton pump inhibitors and iron supplementation.
Well, proton pump inhibitors makes a lot of sense in a patient who can't make acid, doesn't it?
Yes. Yeah, I suppose it would help to, I guess, reset the balance to an extent, but...
Oh, you need that acid in order to turn the iron into an absorbable form.
Yeah, so when you reduce the acid, reduce the iron into its 2+ state, and then makes it more absorbable. But I suppose the mainstay of treatment then is to in a aim to reduce the inflammation that drives the metaplasia. Is that the theory?
That's what people say.
Yeah. But...
Sorry, I tell a lie. It's not the inflammation that drives the metaplasia. What we're talking about, I don't think, is a gastric epithelial carcinoma. I think we're talking about neuroendocrine interstitial cell neoplasia, the cells that are meant to stimulate gastrin secretion. Or meant to just... Now I've got that all twisted up. Jake, help me out here.
It's the enterochromaffin-like cells that seem to be proliferating here, and they've described one patient who's gone on to have a neuroendocrine tumor. The authors highlight that this makes it a significant risk, and yes, the NET and neuroendocrine tumors are vanishingly rare. So I suppose you could say out of 33, one is a moderately significant number. I guess at the moment, this case series probably wouldn't make me change my practice to routinely do endoscopies in this sort of cohort to look for autoimmune gastritis. I suppose the other take home for me was that these patients, at least in the pediatric age group, are presenting with iron deficiency anemia, not with pernicious anemia and features of B12 deficiency. So they clearly have not entirely lost their intrinsic factor production.
So you can't look at distribution of red cell dimensions as a clue to say this patient warrants an endoscopy or this patient does not. You have to endoscope them all.
Well, perhaps, I don't remember if they looked at, I don't think that they've reported the average red cell distribution width in this paper. But most of these patients did have normal B12 levels. In fact, they essentially all had normal B12 levels.
Okay.
So the theory is that in time, in adulthood, given that none of the patients showed any improvement, at least histologically, as they've described, the theory is that they will go on to develop pernicious anemia as adults. I suppose one potential clinical practice changing point for me might be that in a child with iron deficiency anemia, perhaps if it doesn't respond initially, to consider measuring the antiparietal cell antibodies or the anti-intrinsic factor antibodies, which is not a cheap test, but if they've got to that stage and we think that they have sufficient iron intake and yet have persistent iron deficiency anemia but no evidence of GI bleeding, then perhaps measuring the autoantibodies would be of use.
A lot of these kids had what you might call an autoimmune diathesis, didn't they?
Yes, that would be another clinical indicator to it. At least, I think about 50% had some other autoimmune disorder, particularly autoimmune thyroid disease and type 1 diabetes. So,
again, that's a pre-screening for you.
It is pre-screening, absolutely. Though there is the other argument that you're still missing half of them, and in a rare condition, 50% increase is still difficult to identify that population. It doesn't necessarily move your overall clinical identification that much.
So let's just say you give them anti-inflammatories and you give them Flintstone vitamins full of extra iron and the iron deficiency anemia doesn't get better. What do you do Is that your trigger to move to endoscopy?
I think that, I mean, certainly in the adult population, you absolutely would, mostly because you'd be more worried about malignancy as the driver rather than autoimmunity. I think that in the pediatric population in general, we would, at least in from my practice in the UK, you would tend to either have some indication that there was significant GI inflammation. For example, we're worried about Crohn's disease, or we had some other suggestion that there may be a source of bleeding rather than a pure indication for autoimmune gastritis. But this paper, I suppose, has highlighted that as a possibility. The other point I just wanted to note was that a substantial number of the patients, well, a number of the patients did go on to immunosuppressants, including budesonide and azathioprine, and another one I think even had a monoclonal antibody to treat CTLA-4 haploinsufficiency. And those immunosuppressants, at least from my understanding of the paper, were primarily treating their associated autoimmune disorders rather than primarily treating the autoimmune gastritis.
Right. So are pediatric gastroenterologists and hepatologists the appropriate target audience for this particular communication? Shouldn't it have appeared in a hematology journal? Because when a kid comes in with iron deficiency anemia, pale, tummy pain and the rest of it, and there's a microcytosis, then does that kid go to a pediatric hematologist first or to a pediatric GI buddy?
I think that if you have they probably go to a general pediatrician first. But beyond that, I think that the gastroenterologist is probably not an unreasonable step to go to, as long as if there is some associated loose stools or abdominal pain. And many of these patients, it sounds like they did have some associated feature. And the main thrust of the kind of clinical consequence that these authors have described is the need for ongoing follow-up, even if there wasn't histological remission, perhaps even because there wasn't histological remission.
That's more like it. Well, I still feel a little bit miffed that with so few patients to review, that nobody bothered to pull the slides from the file. But if it was good enough for JPGN, I guess it's going to have to be good enough for us. Now the question about referral comes up again in Leferdo, who wanted to streamline referral patterns for obese pediatric patients seen in the community. They derived and they now propose a scoring system to predict fibrosis in the general population, that is, in non-referral center populations, of fat children with abnormal serum transaminase activities, sonographic evidence of liver steatosis, and abnormal findings on elastography. So far as I know, that pattern, persistent over months or years, would prompt, first off, an evaluation for Wilson disease, possibly with liver biopsy. What's your practice there?
So in the vast majority of these patients, if you have a relatively low index of suspicion of Wilson disease or autoimmune hepatitis, then the majority of centers around Europe that I'm aware of would tend to measure copper, ceruloplasmin, immunoglobulins, a baseline set of autoantibodies. And then if there was any doubt in your mind, you may proceed to a 24-hour urine copper collection prior to doing a liver biopsy in general.
So there's your screening procedure. See if there's autoimmunity is demonstrable, and the same to see if there's any evidence of copper abnormalities. Right, but all of that happens in the community?
I think that is a interesting question about where this sort of first line screening happens, and that is quite country dependent upon referral pathways. In some places it will be done by a general pediatrician, some places it will be done by perhaps a pediatric endocrinologist if they're seeing a kind of obesity cohort, and some places it will be done by the specialist gastrohepatologist. So at least in our personal practice in Birmingham, it's a mixture, and it depends directly where the referrals come from as to how much the referring physician has been able to facilitate prior to them coming to our center.
Right, so they come to your center, but you don't want them to come to your center. You want them to stay away. You've got enough work as it is. And you're hoping to say, all right, if we do elastography, then we find out that we don't need to refer the kid to the Mecca. Community elastography?
I think that there is a risk of giving community physicians, general pediatricians, more and more complex tests to do. Certainly in the adult population, that they have demonstrated that empowering primary care physicians to use elastography can have a big benefit in terms of identifying individuals who have significant fibrosis, or cirrhosis, mostly in the adult cohorts, that was otherwise undiagnosed. But our colleagues in general practice and primary care are plenty busy enough already before we give them another complex, relatively complex skill and algorithm to go through. So I think that this paper really is more focused on perhaps people who are seeing all-comer obesity cohorts and helping to identify who to refer on for specialist evaluation, rather than kind of first line seeing everyone in the community.
Well, who are going to be seeing these cohorts of fat kids from the community? If elastography is required, then that winds up in your hepatologist's lap, doesn't it?
I think that there is a move certainly to including elastography in the UK. We call them complications of excess weight clinics, Q clinics. And
okay,
if we're able to include elastography there, then that would be of great benefit. I think that it is not necessarily that we want to keep these patients away from the hepatology service. It is more, I think, about targeting where intervention is needed. And the thrust of this patient's management should be towards the most relevant aspect. If someone has obesity but no end organ damage at that stage, yes, the management is weight loss. But we would perhaps want to focus more intensive dietetic support, physiotherapy support towards those with already evidence of substantial insulin resistance and organ damage. So like any process, it's about risk stratification.
Risk stratification. Well, speaking as a physician, putting on my once was a clinician hat, speaking as a physician who wants to stratify his own risk, I would say, this is too much for me, and I'm going to call the hepatology referral service in order not to miss anything.
Which is a very fair and valid point, and that is probably the mainstay of our referrals. And I think that what is, if there's just one point I will pick out from this paper that I think is particularly important, it is the underlying prevalence of advanced or at least moderate fibrosis in each of these cohorts affects the performance of their scores. And that comes out in their conclusion. You know, the authors state that the scores performed better in the non-selected cohorts of individuals with obesity than in patients who had already been referred to a tertiary liver unit. And this will be true for any scoring system. It will always be best in the type of population in which it was derived. And the original Ghent cohort is a severe obesity cohort, of whom some of those patients will have steatosis. And of those patients, some of those patients will have advanced fibrosis. So their score is built around that model. And then when that has been then transplanted, no pun intended, to a liver unit, you then have a much higher concentration of patients with advanced fibrosis. But mm-hmm. then the performance of the score goes down. So really this tool is much better for those kind of all-comer obesity cohorts rather than those people who are already seeing highly filtered referrals.
I do want to touch again on the idea that although lip service is paid at two instances within the manuscript that I got a chance to see, within the preprint, I should say, to the idea that liver biopsy is the gold standard, the authors chose not to review what a number of institutions had defined as moderate or whatever fibrosis, without a systematic review to say, indeed, these patients with a particular set of sonographic elastography findings indeed had fibrosis, significant or otherwise, then this manuscript leans on a very weak read indeed, or so it seems to me.
And it's probably interesting that one imagines that some of the reviewers perhaps didn't have the same background and training as yourself, which maybe didn't emphasize that in the review process. Speaking from someone who has tried to get these sorts of studies off the ground, then it is a whole nother kettle of fish to initiate the consent and data transfer agreements necessary for slide scanning and then central review of biopsies. But as you say in this paper, it is based upon the correlation between non-invasive markers and histological observations. And therefore, if one of your pillars of the paper is not centrally curated, then your foundations are at risk.
I've seen the sort of things that get sent in as steatohepatitis and steatohepatitis with fibrosis in systemic review studies. And my God, the things that people say out there when they're looking at the biopsies for the first time, that it, a shame that that wasn't picked up and perhaps more made of it, it seems to me. But Jake, our producer, Selma Ertel, is wig-wagging at me to say, it's time to shut down shop. And I'd have to say thank you very much for the chance to discuss these papers. Is there anything that we haven't touched on?
I think we've given them a good go.
Well, more like a Dutch pub. Excuse me for... I think that goes back to the Anglo-Dutch Wars of the 17th century, after which everything that was discreditable was called Dutch. Dutch uncle, Dutch treat, Dutch courage, and then finally the Dutch rub, a brisk attention to the scalp of the calvarium with somebody else's knuckles. Well, we've given him a Dutch rub then, we can say, and I thank you for your patience and for selecting them for JPGN Journal Club.
Always a pleasure.